There are three more chapters, one on analysis of non-stationary signals, one on modeling, and the last one on pattern classification and decision making, which we will not be able to go through in this short course. This chapter is on frequency domain characterization of signals and systems. I would like to mention here both signals and systems because some of the characteristics that are measured could be related to characteristics of the system that generated the signal rather than just the signal. Something like the form factor or RMS value characterizes the signal, not the system that generated it. Whereas if you were to measure the resonance frequency, that could possibly characterize the characteristics of the system that generated, such as the resonance frequency of the ventricular chamber, if you can get some specific measure related to that. So it is possible in some cases to extrapolate the measures that are derived to characterize the system that generated the signal. So let's consider a few introductory aspects as to why analysis in the frequency domain is important or would be desirable in some situations. So there are many biomedical systems that exhibit innate rhythms and periodicity. That's more readily expressed and appreciated in frequency units than time units. I gave you some examples earlier. We will see some more now. Cardiac rhythm, more conveniently expressed in beats per minute, which is a measure of frequency. It's not in hertz or cycles per second, but beats per minute. The number of times something is repeated over a unit of time, which in this case is beats per minute. But it's just a rate of repetition, which is also frequency. Then in terms of the duration of a beat or interval between beats, such as the RR interval. If somebody tells you the RR interval is 643 milliseconds, it does not give you immediately an impression of the heart rate. So cardiac rhythm expressed as 72 beats per minute is more readily understood without the use of any other computational device than the corresponding RR interval as 0.833. So if you tell your patient you have an RR interval of 0.833 second, it doesn't convey the same impression as 72 beats a minute. Similarly, EEG rhythm is conveyed more readily by description in terms of cycles per second or hertz. Only engineers, we use hertz. The term is also used in radio communication, but in general, cycles per second may be more easily understood by a lay person who is not into the engineering or sciences. So cycles per second would be more readily understood and appreciated by a common person than a time domain description such as alpha rhythm having a frequency of 11.5 hertz versus the equivalent period of 0.087 seconds or 87 milliseconds. So it's just a matter of convenience in interpretation and comprehension in these cases. The heart sound signal is an interesting example of a signal with multiple frequency domain characteristics or features. First is the heart rate that is inherent to the cardiac system. Whether it is the heart sound or ECG, or there are some of you working on the ballistocardiogram, the BCG, there is a basic heart rate or rhythm that remains the same, beat-to-beat periodicity or rhythm in beats per minute. That's one rhythm present in the heart sound signal or one frequency-related measure. And then heart sounds within a cardiac cycle exhibit resonance. Multi-compartmental nature of the cardiac system indicates that there could be multiple resonance frequencies. It's a composite spectrum of several dominant or resonance frequencies. The first sound is primarily related to ventricular contraction. But according to Rushmer's theory, it is not just the ventricles causing the sound, but the entire cardiohemic system. Regardless, there is a dominant component from a certain cardiac chamber. And that chamber will have certain resonance frequencies. And the other chambers, too, will have their own resonance frequencies. And they vary depending upon the phase of the cardiac cycle, whether the chamber is in a contracted state or in a relaxed state, whether there is blood present or not, or how much blood is present. And also the effect of disease, such as myocardial ischemia or infarction, that will affect the resonance characteristics of that particular chamber. Constrained flow of blood through an orifice, such as septal defect, ventricular or atrial septal defect, or across a stenosed valve acting as a baffle, leads to turbulence, and that leads to wideband noise. There is no resonance now, but turbulence and wideband noise are frequency domain descriptions of a signal or a system behavior. But we need to consider the distribution of the signal's energy power over a wide band of frequencies now. That leads to the notion of the power spectral density function. So over these items now, we have moved from the notion of the rate of repetition of an event, heart rate in beats per minute, or something in cycles per second of something happening, to resonance frequencies that indicate peaks in the spectrum, could be a line spectrum, to a wideband distribution of energy or power in the frequency domain, which is expressed as a power spectral density. All of these are frequency domain characteristics of a system or a signal. They express different entities or different characteristics, but all of them are frequency domain characteristics, and the heart sound signal has all of these, or could potentially have all of these characteristics. So a general statement would be to investigate the potential use of the spectrum, and the Fourier transform is commonly used, so we will consider the Fourier spectrum and parameters thereof. Can we use the entire spectrum, or could we derive some parameters that will characterize the differences between the various types of signals that we want to analyze and observe in the analysis of biomedical signals? So how do we identify physiological and pathological processes that could modify the frequency content of the corresponding signals? We have already seen examples. And then outline the signal processing tasks or steps needed to perform spectral analysis of biomedical signals and systems. So how do we put all these things together to analyze signals and systems? This is what we are interested in here. And by the way, the phrase spectral analysis is avoided by some authors. It's common in the literature. Some authors prefer spectrum analysis or analysis of the spectrum. By changing the word spectrum, which is a noun, to spectral, which is an adjective, there is a different impression given, not considering the technical meaning of the word spectrum. The word spectral is also associated with the appearance of things that are not physical, including ghosts and spirits. So spectra is, the word spectra and spectral are associated with these imagined things. So some authors say spectral analysis could have other connotations, not frequency domain analysis, but the analysis of perceived ghosts and spirits and so on. So that is another interpretation of that. But we are not doing that. We will do the analysis of the Fourier spectrum in particular here. Or we'll say PSD, power spectral density. And by the way, that the word spectral is there in PSD. Some people say PDS, power density spectrum, not spectral. Okay, let's look at a few examples. The effect of myocardial elasticity was investigated by some authors, by researchers, on heart sound spectra. How will the spectrum of the heart sound be affected by the elasticity and changes to that property of the myocardium? The first and second heart sounds, S1 and S2, are typically composed of low frequency components due to the fluid filled and elastic nature of the cardiohemic system, the entire heart, blood vessels and everything together. There are several classical studies based upon traditional signal processing techniques in the analog domain that I would like to describe to you. You may find these amusing and interesting, but of course nowadays you don't use these techniques. You can use equivalent techniques. Sakai and others proposed recorded heart sound signals using tunable bandpass filters. So they recorded heart sound signals on some device, some on a drum, some on a tape, or some device that could play the signal over and over again. And each time it was played, the bandwidth and the center frequency, not the bandwidth, but the center frequency of the bandpass filter was changed. So if it is a drum on which the signal is recorded, the drum would play once the recorded sound or the cardiac cycle, and the signal would be passed through a bandpass filter with a bandwidth of 20 hertz, tuned over the range 20 to 40 hertz to 400 to 420 hertz. So you start 20 to 40 hertz, measure the output. And then when the drum comes again playing the same sound, you shift the center frequency and go 40 to 60 hertz, and then 60 to 80, and so on, all the way to 420 hertz. And then you get a spectrum. You are analyzing the amount of power or energy contained in the signal in each band as a function of time, if you wish, or consolidated, either way. Then the heart sound spectra in maximum in the range 20 to 40 hertz band was observed. S1 was observed to have peaks at lower frequencies than S2. And S2, they said, exhibited gentle peaking, not a large peak, but further peaks between 60 and 220 hertz, indicating there is more high frequency content in S2 than S1. So this is an old technique. Now you just say FFT in MATLAB, it'll do that. You don't have to run the sound over and over again. And you don't have to fiddle with analog filters. But that was done before the days of computers, or before computers were popular. Gerberg and others applied a computer program to simulate a filter bank. So they took that same notion and developed a computer program. The references are in the book. So some of these are before the days of FFT. FFT was proposed in 1967, 40 years ago. So before that, to compute the Fourier transform on a computer was not easy. It would take, I don't know how many hours. Yes. That's true. That's true. Well, we have the Fourier transform, and then we need to compute. If you want to compute the Fourier transform on a computer, you need to discretize. So you have the DFT, which we will see now. We'll see the formulation of the DFT. FFT, the fast Fourier transform, is simply one method to compute the DFT, the discrete Fourier transform, in a computationally efficient manner. And the requirement to use 2 to the power of n samples, having an FFT array that is 256, 512, log 1024, and so on, a number of samples, is again a requirement of the first FFT algorithm that was proposed. And there are other FFT, I shouldn't say FFT, fast computational algorithms to compute the discrete Fourier transform efficiently, even when the number of samples is not 2 to the power of n. MATLAB does it somehow. How, I don't know, but it does somehow, and computers are nowadays so fast, you don't have to even use the FFT if you don't have one. You could compute the DFT in a matter of a few milliseconds. But what you say is right. FFT is simply a tool to compute the DFT. And the D there, the discrete, is also a matter of computational convenience. What you're getting is a Fourier transform. So I would sometimes just say FT. So I simply say FT of X of T is equal to X omega and so on. So it's just a Fourier transform. Is that what you meant? Yeah. And as I mentioned just now, the fast Fourier transform was proposed only in 1966 or 67. And before that, computers were much slower than what you have now. And without the FFT, the computation of the discrete Fourier transform involves many, many more computations, multiplications and additions, and it would take several hours on those computers in the 50s and 60s. So it was not a popular technique at that time, unless you had a really big machine to perform spectrum analysis. But here, in this study, Gerberg and others, they used as a basis the other studies where spectrum analysis had been done using the analog spectrum analysis method of having a filter bank that is tuned over different frequencies. They got averaged power spectra of S1 and S2 of 1,000 adult males, 32 high school children, and so on, and averaged the PSDs of S1 and S2. The peak power in the range of 60 to 70 hertz was observed. Power levels lower than minus 10 dB beyond 150 hertz, essentially low frequency. And the PSD of S2 was observed to have slightly more high frequency. So that observation was repeatedly made by several researchers, but using different tools. So what I want to show here or convey to you is the fact that researchers used several different tools to study these frequency domain characteristics of the heart sounds and other biomedical signals using various tools as available at those times, essentially leading to the same observations. But the resolution of analysis would be different in terms of the number of samples on the frequency axis and so on. More recently, in the 1970s, when FFT became the popular tool, Yoganathan and others applied FFT analysis to S1 and S2. Soon after the FFT came, everybody applied FFT to every problem that had been previously addressed using other tools, but now this was the new tool. And now, of course, not now, for the past 10 years, wavelets have become popular, so everybody applies wavelets to all of the old problems again using this new technique. And we were talking earlier the same thing about neural networks. Previously, the classical pattern recognition techniques of linear discriminant functions and Bayesian classifiers were used, and then suddenly neural networks appeared 20 years ago, maybe, or 25 years ago, and then that became the popular tool. So we have a similar situation here. Heart sounds have been analyzed using different tools that were available at those times. Yoganathan and others applied FFT analysis. These are, I'm giving you representative papers from certain time periods using certain tools. And they obtained spectra of 250 millisecond windows with S1, and they did averaging of the power spectral density. So it is synchronized averaging as we have been talking about. The spectrum of S1 was observed to have peaks in a low frequency range, 10 to 50 hertz, a medium frequency range, 50 to 140 hertz. But S2 had peaks in the low range, 10 to 80, medium 80 to 220 now, a little broader, and also high frequency, 220 to 400, they said. But I have not seen much beyond 120, 150 hertz. They say they saw some peaks in the 220 to 400 hertz range, but they would be very small compared to the other peaks. There is an interesting study of Adolf and others who applied a dynamic spectrum analyzer to study the frequency content of S1, the first heart sound, during isovolumic contraction. That is soon after the QRS complex. The center frequency of the filter with 20 hertz bandwidth was varied from 30 to 70 hertz in steps of 10 hertz. So 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, the center frequency, and the bandwidth is 20. So to do this, you would have to do what I said earlier, that is record the signal, play it repeatedly, and each time the signal starts, you switch the center frequency of the bandpass filter and measure the output. And that is what was called a dynamic spectrum analyzer in hardware. No computer. No digital computer, it's an analog computer. The outputs of the filters were averaged over 10 pre-recorded consecutive beats. So it was not one beat, one cycle, but 10 cycles. And the ratios of the average peak voltage of the filter So you measure the peak voltage of each filter's output to that of the full S1 during isovolumic contraction was computed. Their hypothesis was that the frequency content of S1 during isovolumic contraction in that particular period should depend upon the relative contributions of mass and elasticity of the left ventricle. The mass of the left ventricle with blood content remains constant during that period because, as I mentioned in the introduction to the cardiac system, during isovolumic contraction, after the ventricles are filled with blood, the atria have squeezed, the ventricles are full, the ventricles begin to contract, and that will seal the atrioventricular valves. The mitral and tricuspid valves close. So the atria are shut off. The aortic and pulmonary valves have not yet opened, and the pressure inside the ventricles have not built up yet. And the ventricles contract, and in that phase, the amount of blood will remain constant. The tension will increase, the pressure will increase, but it is called the isovolumic contraction phase. In that phase, the mass remains the same of the ventricle, in particular the left ventricle and also the right ventricle, but most studies concentrate on the left ventricle. Therefore, the frequency content of S1 should decrease in case of diseases that reduce the elasticity of the ventricles, such as myocardial infarction on the left ventricle. So they did this study. This is from 1970, fairly soon after the FFT, but perhaps they didn't have the FFT or didn't have digital computers then, I don't know. They used analog methods. So here is the spectrum, but obtained at discrete steps of 10 hertz using a bandpass filter, and the normal heart sound spectrum of S1 during this isovolumic contraction. So it's a very specific part of S1. The spectrum was that for normal subjects where there is a clear peak at 40 hertz and then it decreases. And in the case of acute myocardial infarct, it's reduced. That peak was completely absent in their observation. And in the case of healed myocardial infarct, again, there was no peak after 30 hertz. So that was their major finding, which is very interesting, that there is a clear reduction in the, it's not clear what you want to call this. This is not high frequency. This is not even medium frequency according to what the others categorized. But in this range of 30 to 50 hertz or 60 hertz, there was no peak, meaning there was that resonance that exists in normal cases is not present in the case with myocardial infarction. Of course, it depends upon how much of the tissue is affected. How big is the infarct? So spectrum analysis in this manner was done in the 60s and 70s using analog techniques, and characteristics of the heart sounds were demonstrated in this manner, and it was shown that heart sounds could be analyzed using these analog techniques in the frequency domain. I say frequency domain, but the signal is still in the time domain. The filters operate in real time in the time domain, but the output, the parameters that are measured are in the frequency domain. The characterization is in the frequency domain in terms of resonance. So it was shown that these are useful in diagnosis of certain types of cardiovascular pathology. So let's consider now frequency analysis of murmurs to diagnose valvular defects. So we have seen that cardiovascular defects and diseases cause high frequency noise-like sounds that are called murmurs. And several traditional techniques have been applied, or simpler computational techniques have been applied in the past, again, to heart sounds using techniques such as the zero crossing rate and a few other simple measures. So Yoshimura and others again use tunable bandpass filters. Now the range is bigger, 18 to 1425 hertz, 1400 hertz, to process recorded PCG signals. And they said in the case of mitral stenosis, there is what they call rumble. There are specific terms that have been used in the literature to describe the nature of murmurs. Of course, murmur is anything, but then there are terms such as rumble and blow and so on that characterize certain types of murmurs. So the diastolic rumble of mitral stenosis was observed to span a fairly low frequency range of 20 to 200 hertz. Whereas the diastolic blow of aortic stenosis was observed to be spread over 200 to 1,600 hertz. So these studies established the nature of these sounds and also some terms to characterize these murmurs. There are some interesting points to observe here. Mitral stenosis affects the transfer of blood across the mitral valve from the atrium, left atrium, to the left ventricle. And this is during diastole of the ventricles. So what you have happening here is the mitral valve should be completely open and allow blood to just come down from the left atrium to the left ventricle, but instead, because it is stenosed, the valve is impeding the flow. So you don't expect high frequency content there because the pressure gradient is low, the atria are just slowly squeezing, and the blood just has to go across there, and the ventricles are relaxed. And instead of being fully open, there is a baffle. So there is some low frequency, what they call rumble. And the frequency content is low. Whereas aortic regurgitation has a higher pressure gradient. Aortic regurgitation happens when the aortic valve doesn't shut completely when the ventricles are relaxing. There is a systemic blood pressure on the other side, and if the aortic valve allows a hole, it cannot close completely, so it creates a small hole, and blood comes back into the left ventricle. The pressure gradient is larger, and quite likely this hole or defect will be fairly small. So that creates higher frequency. So depending upon the events that occur at those instants of time and cardiac phase, the nature of the murmur could be predicted and understood to be high frequency, low frequency, what is called a blow or what is called a rumble. So you need to tie these back to the dynamics of the cardiovascular system and the event that is happening at that phase. Van Vollenhoven, they used tunable bandpass filter again, 50 hertz bandwidth, center frequency tuned in steps of 50 hertz, 100 millisecond window in the diastolic phase of recorded PCG was analyzed, and the murmur of mitral stenosis, they said, is limited to less than 400 hertz. The murmur of aortic insufficiency combined with mitral stenosis had more high frequency up to 1,000 hertz. That's what they observed. There are situations where a patient has multiple valvular abnormalities. Sarkady and others, I mentioned earlier, used synchronized averaging of the envelopes of PCGs. They also did averaging of the power spectral densities of PCG signals over several cardiac cycles computed using the FFT. I'll show you examples of this later on. Johnson and others studied FFT-based power spectral densities of systolic murmur due to aortic stenosis. And the PSDs of systolic windows of duration 86, 170, and 341 milliseconds were obtained and averaged over 10 cardiac cycles. So they did synchronized averaging too of the power spectral density. Note that you cannot average heart sounds because you will cancel out the vibrations that are not of any specific wave shape, and there could be destructive cancellation of the phases of the vibration. You cannot average the Fourier transform directly because it is complex, and if there is change in phase, then if you average the FFT, the Fourier transforms, not necessarily FFT, the Fourier transforms that are complex of several murmurs or heart sounds of the same phase, you might end up with something that is canceled out and maybe nothing at the end because, again, there is no guarantee that you will line them up properly. So you have to average power spectral densities which are all positive. And then minor fluctuations in the estimation process will be removed. So the hypothesis here was that higher murmur frequencies are generated as the severity of aortic stenosis increases. So they studied several cases of aortic stenosis where the degree of stenosis of the valve was established somehow. And what they did was they measured the trans-aortic valvular systolic pressure gradient with a catheter. They put a transducer in and measured the pressure gradient across the aorta, and also fluoroscopy. And they found that to be in the range of 10 to 140 millimeters of mercury. The spectral power ratios are computed with the bands 25 to 75 hertz as a reference of what they call constant area. And they said that is related to normal sounds, which is okay. And then 75 to 150 as the predictive area in the spectrum related to murmurs. This is fairly low frequency. I don't know why they didn't go beyond this. They could have used higher frequency ranges. But it's not guaranteed that murmur may not always have significant energy beyond 150 hertz. There could be more depending upon the severity of the artifact. So perhaps their argument is that this is a better range than a higher frequency range because low levels of stenosis may not give frequency components beyond 150 hertz. I'll show you some spectra later on, or right here. I'll reduce the zoom a little bit. Okay. So here you see four cases, different patients. This is the spectrum, 0 to 250 or a little more than 250 hertz, and normalized to one there, the peak. They took the band 25 to 75 hertz as the reference, or constant area, CA that they called. They took the area under the power spectral density. And these are averaged PSDs. And they took the band 75 to 150 hertz as the area related to the murmurs and called that the predictive area, or PA. In this patient, the gradient is 12 and PA over CA is 0.244. In this case, the gradient is 60. I believe that gradient is in terms of millimeters of mercury. So that's the difference in pressure across the aortic valve. In this case, it is 0.523. There is more energy here, 75 to 150. Note that there is now more energy after 150 hertz than here, but not significant. There's more increase here, so that's why they chose that band. Here, the gradient is 103 millimeters of mercury, and this ratio is 0.629, and there it is 140 millimeters of mercury. That ratio is 0.833. So there is increase in that ratio, more energy in the 75 to 150 hertz band as compared to 25 to 75. And below 25, there might not be much. I'm not sure what the bandwidth of their transducer is. Perhaps below this, it's just artifactual or there isn't much significant energy there.